Okay.
This is one. Yeah, this is one of the photos, and I have the gallery at the other end.
Well, who do you want to take this to introduce Anne? Can I come here and come to Anne? Okay.
In the introduction, I'm
going to search Anne. As soon as we get them up, guys, go shoot them up. I'm hoping we get a mic.
Oh, no.
Could you possibly play some so I can get
a... Oh, yeah, sure. So where to control from here? James, can you turn the audio on? Yeah.
Showed in the young, fit and soothing, we stretched along the mountain road that was created by the mortar engine, mine on one side and covered by clinkers. In places, the blood was so thick our shoes stuck momentarily to the road, and we stumbled onto chunks of human flesh and other things. Teddy bears, backpacks, slippers of those who had gone before.
Do you want to rewind that or no?
Yeah, let's rewind it. Let's rewind. I press play here.
You press play. You press play here.
Yeah.
Can she get into her power play from here?
He's going to hit just this one button here, and he's going to hit this, and it's going to go into the
But button. Is he going to do it that
way? Yeah.
Okay.
Where I can be here. Right, oh, good point. Now, can we do an audio test? Do we have the mic so we can do an audio test for the camera?
The camera's working.
What's the part?
Didn't take a sweet car.
Okay. Well, I first saw my hand and I was like a bad night. I was like, is it Cameron? Like, it's Cameron. Like, I don't know. I saw that.
Maybe that's the
Can you put a light? I don't want to miss it. Both yourself down something really tremendous.
For
Oh, everyone's in the chat. The image, the filming is early.
I like that.
It reminds me of the game. Remember that game Operation where you had
to
like
the
mat
touch.
Yeah.
The pictures are just kind of going.
Okay, but you're in control of that.
Yeah, the cabinets are open. I just don't have any knobs. I gotta get some knobs. Sorry. I brought you another battery because we really only are happy for about 3 or 4 hours.
Okay. Well, I don't know. I shouldn't use the papers, should I? Whatever. It would be great if you'd start that off.
I'm going to ask a question.
Is there also a hand around, Mike?
I brought two. Jay seems to be on top of the power board.
She's
going to hit it, but are you going to make sure it's actually
on?
Oh, here.
Okay. How does that change? Where does she run off to? Anna? Sorry. Hey, I have to pick you up.
Oh, really?
Really.
One, two.
I have no idea where we can actually put it. Maybe that's where
you can. Yeah, that goes in the back.
Just hold there. Hold on. Just go maybe right here, because that's where it's down.
Yeah, somewhere on the track it is the best, I think. Hello? Hello?
Now you're coming.
Yes. Who am I? Is this the person who's wearing lights before me?
Okay.
and then we have questions for you.
Mm-hmm. Good. Thank you.
I have one of those hand things so that if somebody is far off in the audience, that I walk to them with it, or... Okay.
Good job. Good job, Jay. Am I sitting in your seat? I will. Hello? Hello?
Okay. Is this working? Yes.
Is this working? That's bad.
Good morning, all. Good morning to those of you who are watching this from a distance. And welcome to Evidence 00, Harvard Law School, the year 2000. This morning's project is the group Gaia, and I turn the proceedings over to Hanukkah.
Good morning. I'd like to start with a short presentation.
what you mean?
Golden young fit and feeble, who trekked along the mountain road that was created by the water in him, lying on one side and covered by snipers. In places, the blood was so thick our shoes stepped on the narrow into the road, and we stumbled onto chunks of human flesh and other remnants. Teddy bears, backpacks, slippers of those that had gone before. She gave her name as Marianne. She spoke to her mother and 2 dozen other women in the hall in the meantime. Richard raped her and the others and forced them to have sex with uniformed soldiers deployed to the war. She and her mother each had to watch as the other was gang raped 3 times a day, every day, for 4 months. She was released only because she became visibly pregnant. Upon her release, her jailer said, "Go bear our serving the children." You could smell the mass grave long before you could see it. The corpses were dressed in civilian clothes. They had gunshot wounds to the back of their heads. Their decaying hands were bound behind their backs. One prisoner was forced to bite off the testicles of another, who as he died had a live pigeon stuffed into his mouth to stifle his scream. An eyewitness, testifying later at the United Nations International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, described the behavior of the guards during this act as being like a crowd at a sports match.
Good morning. This is Gaia's presentation on gathering evidence in Kosovo. In particular, we will be looking at the hearsay rule, or actually the lack of the hearsay rule before the Yugoslavia Tribunal, and asking you, as Americans and as an international audience, whether you believe a child whether a trial can be fair and just without that rule. But we'd also like to go beyond it, because we have an incredible guest speaker here today, and she's actually been there gathering evidence, investigating, as she likes to put it herself. So any questions on a more broad scale are also more than welcome. As you know, we are supposed to, the ones giving presentations are supposed to give a poll or take a poll. I was thinking about asking all of you, how many of you are Americans? But obviously that's not going to work. And then how many of you come from a common law system? That's also not going to work. So my question is going to be, how many of you do not come from a common law system? Which is basically the same question. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and our international participants, or most of them. James, how many countries, how many nations, how many nationalities?
At the moment, we're on 12 nationalities and 9 countries on our remote audience.
Well, the idea is today, as it was mentioned at the beginning of this course, to investigate or to find out what the internet has to offer in the future of education. So what we have done, besides all these computers and all this technical wizardry that sometimes goes wrong, is to invite people from Mexico, Peru, Argentina, the Netherlands, Ireland, Spain, France, Italy. We have live audience from Japan. It's going to be translated here, and hopefully emails are going to be sent and questions are going to be asked. We have people from Singapore all about this question. It's obviously still experimental, but let's hope it goes well. Now I guess it is time to introduce our guest speaker. Her name is Ms. Anna Rubezame. She comes from Berlin. And if you care to look at our website, she has an impressive curriculum vitae, and her language skills seem incredible. She has been in Kosovo, and she was there from August until November of last year, literally gathering evidence, as I already said. And I think it's time for her to tell you more. Her presentation should take about 10 minutes. Will be on the general idea of what she did, what project she was working for, and then she will address the more specific issue of the hearsay rule in the court.
Thank you, Hanika. thank you for inviting me. Thanks to the group and the class. It's a great honor and pleasure to be here. Thank you for your introduction. I look, I was too kind, I'm afraid. I was part of the humanitarian law documentation project. That is, that was a special project by a group called International Crisis Group, that is normally some kind of a think tank. And what the idea was behind the project, a couple of law clerks to the tribunal had experienced how evidence was lost in Bosnia because the investigation started so late. So the idea was to move in very quickly while the conflict was still going on and starting to gather evidence while the refugees why the refugees still had it in their memory very fresh. And the whole project started in Tirana, Albania, a group of, at that time, only a few lawyers, together with Albanian translators, went to refugee camps and started to take statements. The structure developed while the project was going on. The questions that were asked were discussed with the ICTY, and they made clear what their priorities were. What they wanted from the group was a general idea of what happened, where, about how many people were killed or raped or whatever crime was committed, and so that they would be able to point their investigators very quickly to certain crime scenes. As the NATO troops moved in around June 11, the refugees started to return much quicker to Kosovo than expected. So the project moved unexpectedly, very quickly from Tirana to Jakova. And we used the Tirana office as a data processing office. It was a huge operation. Altogether, we were 80 people, of which about 20 people were lawyers, taking statements and supervising the interviewers. We had local staff members that were either translating for us while we were ourselves taking statements or taking the interviews themselves based on the forms that we had developed. And later on, the international legal person would ask follow-up questions. Our headquarters was in Jakova, Kosovo, and we stayed there from July to December. December 28th was the last official day of the project. That's Kosovo, and the area that we covered was about half of what you see in this map. From here towards the west, that's Jakova. Jakovica in Serbian, all the maps are in Serbian. That was one of the problems that we were facing, that there are two names for every geographic location. That's the office. We had, as I said, altogether 80 people, 13 cars that we took out in order to conduct the interviews. As soon as we were in Kosovo, the interviews were conducted in the towns where the witnesses were living with the help of a local NGO, and that local NGO had been in operation since 1989 and was called the Center for Human Rights. They had established the credibility with the Kosovo people, and we have we linked up with them in order to do the work more efficiently and quickly. And altogether, we took about 2,500 to 3,000 statements. This is a typical interview situation. An old man giving a statement to one of our local interviewers, and an international is also around somewhere. And you see the man in the right here in the foreground is the person from the NGO. Exhumations were conducted by the forensic teams. most of the forensic teams were seconded government teams to the ICTY. The US sent an FBI team. Germany sent a team comprised of criminal investigators. They did the exhumations, or they did many of the exhumations, conducted forensic evidence gathering, and then reburied, or helped the locals to rebury the dead. That's an ICTY team, not quite sure from which country. It could be Dutch. So some of the evidence on the table. And this would be a typical reburial site. In order to remind people of what has happened, what Kosovars would regularly do is to have large reburial sites on the roads, so that you would, while you were driving by, you would see the graves. This was one of those large reburials that were also used to have the international community pay attention to what has happened. This is how they would look from the street. That's what you would see everywhere, all over the country. It's also a very typical picture. The missing people and the dead people, you had pictures of them everywhere. One, in order to find out whether the person, whether somebody knows anything, if the person has not been confirmed dead, and also to remind people that these people have died. That's a typical picture from the destruction caused by burnings. One, the main objective of the Serb paramilitary was to get the people out of the country, and a fairly effective method was to burn. And the old town of Jokava was completely destroyed, and this is basically how it looks. That was the mosque, one of the mosques in the town that was destroyed. And in retaliation, while we were already there, this was a Serbian church that was blown up in the middle of the day, and all we heard was a big bomb. And the Italian K4 did not catch the people who did it. This was a typical interview situation. One of the problems we faced was that the families usually gathered all together. When you come in, you had your witness and 25 other people. And the problem would be, of course, that they would all chime in trying to tell the story. And you can, there were certain things to guard against that. And we threw, sometimes we made sure that we only had the witness in the room, but oftentimes that was impossible, particularly when we weren't quite sure yet whether or not we're going to take a statement or whether we are just there for information gathering. You would sit on the floor on those mattresses, and the person would tell you the story. This was very typical. That was an evidence of NATO bombing, one of those bridges. And that was it in terms of our project. The problems that we faced with the evidence gathering process. As I said in the beginning, we did not aim for to get sworn statements. That was not our task. We were there in order to screen for the ICTY investigators what were the major events. The ICTY investigators are very limited in number, and this is why they necessarily have to focus on certain larger events. And our database is searchable, and they did tell us that they were searching the database in order to get a more a fuller picture of what had happened. We were not the only organization there. You had the government seconded teams that I had told you about, and also K4 did some of the war crime investigation. The problems we had while we were taking those statements. The typical memory problem, I guess, that any criminal investigator faces, was very pronounced. because of a couple of reasons. The events were so traumatic that that influenced people. That's at least the feeling that I got. And they, because they had certain incentives to remember precise numbers. They had incentives by the tribunal to remember dates, for instance. Because the tribunal had, during the refugee crisis, they went into refugee camps trying to identify certain very important witnesses, and they would get priority, and they would be priority in the sense that they would be taken out of their country, out of Albania, out of Macedonia, before other witnesses. So you would have an incentive to have seen things, and that was one of the problems that people would have an incentive to be eyewitnesses. They, because they recounted the events again and again, and they talked to each other, you would have people who would immediately tell you a precise number of people who were there at this particular event, a precise number of dead people. And then later on you would find out by taking many statements or by asking them again or asking follow-up questions that they don't know the precise number of people. Often, the admission that you don't know it precisely or that you have forgotten it was difficult. I personally had to learn that because if I don't know something, I readily admit it. And it took me a couple of statements in order to realize that that oftentimes is not the case. And there, I think, more so than in other areas. Since there was such a strong incentive to uncover crimes, you had instances of briefing of witnesses. So somebody had said something, and then a KLA member in one instance, and a local NGO in another instance would brief the witness in order to make sure that the right information was getting out. So that's something that we had to consider. In terms of hearsay, the tribunal rule says that you can have any relevant evidence that has probative value admitted. That's very different to what we have in many other countries. The tribunal rules of procedure and evidence in general are very, are rather flexible because the tribunal can make its own rules under the competence international law principle. And in one of their early cases, the Tadic case, they made a decision that hearsay evidence is admissible. We didn't want, or we were trying not to have, not to take statements from hearsay witnesses. But people really wanted their story to be heard for various reasons. And sometimes they would, in the beginning, suggest to you that they were an eyewitness. And then later on you would find out that that was not quite true. Then you had the incidences when we did take the statement of hearsay was when there was a woman whose husband was killed or was said to be killed because somebody had told her that, most likely a KLA member, but the body was not found yet. And she was hoping that he was missing, but she had heard that he was killed, and that would be the case where we would take the statement because there was a fairly strong suggestion that that something had happened to that person. That's it fairly quickly. Thank you very much for setting it up so professionally. It's very exciting to see what's possible in today's classroom. Thanks also to NYU for giving me the opportunity to have this kind of a job for 4 months.
Thank you very much.
I'd like to just start with a question before we ask you whether you have any particular questions specifically relating to hearsay and whether our international audience also has some questions. What would be a typical line of questioning? I don't know, Professor Nesson always gives us examples of how to question a witness. In a war crime scene, what would you ask?
Well, the first question of our team, we were working in teams and we were fairly autonomous. Our first question was, were you an eyewitness?
Right.
And then the person would say yes, and then we would ask them, what have you seen? That's number one. Get a fairly general idea of what had happened, and then go into detail. Now, the guidance we got from the tribunal is not to go into detail,
right,
because then that might cause problems later on.
And why would they have such a rule?
Not to go into detail?
Not
for us?
Because how can you make sure that the evidence is reliable if you cannot go on question? At least you have to be able to cross-examine the witness.
There, every witness that was identified by us or by K4 or by OSCE would be re-interviewed by the ICTY investigator. Anybody. Even the government seconded teams, if they did take statements, that same rule would apply. That means the ICTY was concerned that the statement that we had, if it is very detailed, and then the witness contradicts him or herself later on, that could be used by the defense. Therefore, we were supposed to be taking rather general statements. Right. And most of the times we did.
Right. I don't know whether there are questions burning from the international audience. Anything? Yes?
Yeah, we have one question in from Tanya in Yugoslavia. She's from Yugoslavia. She wants to know whether evidence will be gathered for crimes committed by NATO and by the Albanians.
Yes. We had. I'm sorry I didn't mention that. Great. Hi, Tanya. Tanya was my classmate.
I believe Tanya is from Serbia. She's
right.
Italian,
right.
And Serbian, so we obviously know.
And we had a great class with Tanya and an Albanian named Adita, who's now in Kosovo, in the same class while the war was going on. So that was a great opportunity to discuss. But to the question, we had a team that was called Minorities and that focused on crimes committed by the Albanians against the Serbs. So we would go into areas where there were Serb communities and take evidence of killings, whatever has happened by the minority team. And the tribunal is regarding that has a very high priority, also for K4.
Right. So it's not winner's justice anymore?
I don't think so. The tribunal is certainly not the winner. And yes.
Okay. Any more questions that should be addressed immediately, or shall I ask our American audience? Right.
Yeah. Trevor, is Canadian, asked, did you use tape recorders as well as handwritten notes as a mode of recording statements?
Again, because of the tribunal's guidance not to take too many detailed statements, recordings would be almost dangerous, because if it is discoverable, that by the way is not quite clear yet whether or not those statements would ever be discoverable. But if it is, then you might have the problem that you have a variety of witness accounts that contradict each other.
We have another question from Oliver from Australia. Is there are sufficient witness statements about the same event? Is this treated as corroborative evidence of that event, even though there may be no physical evidence?
I'm not sure how the tribunal treats that, to tell you the truth. But we would, one of our tasks was to write a report on what has happened in Kosovo, and we used a variety of witness statements in order to make sense of a puzzle. In order to get the pieces together.
I'd like to ask a question to the people in the class. We've been learning a lot about hearsay, and it's, if I understand it correctly, it's fundamental to the American jury system, and it's a guarantee that the evidence that has been admitted it's in order to make the evidence credible, basically. What are your feelings about having international tribunals that don't have a hearsay rule, that don't, they can make their own rules, and the only rule being that evidence has to be probative, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. Does anybody have a question or an opinion on that? Right. I'm sorry, I have to run around like Oprah or something.
Yeah, my question is just that you mentioned that there is no hearsay prohibition in the tribunal, yet you also said that you were very concerned about not collecting hearsay evidence, that you would rather have evidence that was not hearsay. So that says to me that there must be sort of some sort of rule in the back of people's minds about hearsay, or some kind of unwritten rule that hearsay evidence isn't as good. Is that spelled out at all?
Spelled out where?
Has anybody told you this? Where did you get the concept that you shouldn't be collecting hearsay evidence, since the rules say that you can?
Well, since we were screeners again, you know, you would look at the most obvious, which is the eyewitness first. And it makes sense to be careful with hearsay. And because it makes sense, I think you have to be careful. And the tribunal is careful, but sometimes you can't do without hearsay. And America, with a strong suggestion not to admit hearsay, has over 15 exceptions to the rule. And that's because oftentimes...
Right, so your argument would be that maybe the Americans shouldn't... They're very strong in wanting a hearsay rule in international tribunals, I believe.
That I'm not sure about, because they played a huge part in setting up the ICTY. And in setting up the ICTY, they, together with other nations, decided that the tribunal should have a large amount of flexibility. And Judge Gabriel Kirk McDonald came to speak and said to the conference on the establishment of the International Criminal Court, she gave a speech to one of the preparatory commissions that is setting up the rules of procedure and evidence. And she was urging the delegations not to come up with too detailed rules on evidence and procedure. And she gave the example of the ICTY as a very positive example of where judges who have a large degree of flexibility are not abusing that privilege.
Could I interject a comment here? To what extent does it strike you, in respect to this question of the need for a hearsay rule, that it's to judges that this matter is to be tried rather than to a jury? That is, to what extent is the American hearsay rule really a product of the jury as a black box entity, where what you're trying to do is guard against possibilities that a verdict could be impeached on the assumption that jurors wouldn't understand and would misevaluate the probative value of hearsay. Whereas if you're dealing with supposedly sophisticated judges who understand hearsay, that they can be presumed not to over-evaluate the probative value of hearsay. To what extent, in other words, is the international tribunal in a deep and fundamental way different from the American trial situation with respect to this hearsay question?
Is this a question for the class?
I'd love anybody to respond, or not, if they choose.
Do you trust judges, basically, to fulfill this rule?
Let's just see a poll in the class. How many would say the International Tribunal, on the basis of what you've studied in evidence so far, would be better off not having a hearsay rule and leaving it to the judge's discretion to make sure that the evidence that's presented builds a credible case, whether based on hearsay in some instances or not? How many would say yes, no hearsay rule? How many would like to see the International Tribunal have a hearsay rule? So it's like overwhelming for no hearsay rule. And the reason why you'd like to see a hearsay rule, those few, some sense of protection, what would you say?
I think it's for some sense of legitimacy to the, say, the Serbians or the Yugoslavs, because I tend to think that they see the tribunal as justice being imposed on them, or they're being judged in some way. And I think that in order to make the, I mean, even given that the fact they're judges, in order to make it seem like every procedural sort of safeguard was given, and they still found these people guilty, I think that would sort of send a stronger message.
In other words, the rules themselves would lend legitimacy even beyond whatever the body of evidence is.
Yes, I mean, I think given two situations with or without the hearsay rule, it's always, I mean, you could see someone from Serbia or from the Yugoslav position impeaching the outcome by saying, well, if we had a hearsay rule, then, you know, they wouldn't bring all these people's statements who are probably maybe coerced, or I mean, I could just seen it from a sort of devil's advocate perspective.
Okay, thanks.
I believe there are some questions from the Japanese audience, so maybe we should address them. And it's very late at night for them, so maybe they want to tune out.
Similar to the question or the answer that the gentleman said over there, if the ICTY, by not having a hard hearsay rule, does that jeopardize its legitimacy in the eyes of those parties, for example, the Serbians and others in the international community, who feel that perhaps any verdict that comes from the court is not as credible as one that would have a hearsay rule?
That's definitely a concern, I would say. Nevertheless, something that also comes up in the ICC negotiations time and time again, we have to remember what crimes we are dealing with here. And if you have war crimes, crimes against humanity and genocide, then you will have to be, those crimes are on a scale that is different from the average crime we're facing in general, and because they're different on a scale, I think the protection that you should, I mean, the rules say very clearly that we have to ensure the right of a fair trial, time and time again, even in that particular rule that says any relevant evidence is admissible as long as it has probative value. The next line says, you know, you have to ensure the right of a fair trial, and so they're very concerned, but the scale of the crime, I think, makes a difference.
And this is just one question I have. So you think there's a relationship based on the enormity of the crime or what's at stake, perhaps the rules might be somehow liberalized? Is that the idea?
I think I was thinking about it more in terms of that there's so much more evidence available. And you know, whether it's how many people have heard of it, or oftentimes you have hearsay evidence and you don't have an eyewitness account because the people were told to look away. Now, that type of evidence should be admissible, in my opinion.
Up in the corner here,
up there. In the corner there, okay.
And while that's happening, let me just respond to an online comment from Trevor. Trevor says, the problem with my question is, isn't it the case that hearsay evidence would be excluded in trials to a judge altogether? That's a nice point, but I think actually it turns out not to be quite true, because at least in the United States, we have this phenomenon of some cases tried to a jury, some cases are tried to a judge, and although theoretically the rules of evidence apply in the trials to a judge, it's typically the case that the rules are much more lax
in the so-called bench trials, the trials just to a judge. And when an objection is made, for example, on hearsay grounds, the typical judicial response will be, I'll take it for what it's worth. That is, the judge resists ruling on the objection. And so you don't get this fine sort. And the judge, in doing that, is confident that the result that he or she produces will not be overturned on appeal, because the typical presumption on appeal is that the judge, even though not explicit, properly applies the rules of evidence, and if the evidence shouldn't have been considered, the judge wouldn't consider it. It would only be problematic if the judge actually wrote an opinion and based their opinion on hearsay. Now, some advocates, Eric Saltzman was an example, in trying cases to judges would insist on the judge ruling on the objection, that is saying, taking it for what it's worth isn't good enough, judge, I want you to rule on the objection. And that creates a difficulty and a tension, and some judges will be pushed into it and some judges won't. But the upshot and the point that I would make to you is that in actual practice in the United States, the hearsay rules are indeed very much rooted in the fact that the case is going to a jury, and quite a looser set of rules is typically applied when the case is tried to judges, leaving it to the judges' overall discretion to make sure that the evidence supports the end result.
It seems like so far we've been talking about the hearsay rule only as it applies to statements made by people that were not eyewitnesses. I guess my question is whether all the statements that would be submitted as evidence, whether the people who made those statements would testify before the tribunal themselves and be subject to cross-examination. Because it doesn't seem feasible with so many statements that could happen. But if the statements themselves were submitted, then all of them would arguably be hearsay.
That's right, unless you have the witness here at the tribunal. And I mean, that's just why we have, there's a huge witness, there's a huge program to have people in the Netherlands, housing them, protecting their identity. There's large discussion about anonymous witnesses, because that happens quite frequently as well. And they're there, so you don't have the hearsay problem.
Bettina points out that the typical situation we deal with the hearsay rule is somewhat different from the war crime situation, because in the war crime situation, most of the witnesses to the events have actually been murdered, and so the difficulty of actually getting the eyewitness testimony also bears in some way on our thinking about the problem.
There's another question here from the audience.
My question is, how do defendants become named defendants, and are they, is it more like groups or individuals, and what about cross-examination of witnesses?
That's a great question. That is a question that I have myself posed to the tribunal without getting an answer. There are different strategies behind who is named. There were five people named, as you might recall, and the strategy in Kosovo was to go from the top to catch the top, and not to start with the person who actually committed the murders. And you can feel about that any way you want, but the tribunal is not going to, that's safe to say, I think, they're not going to indict everybody who committed a crime.
The explanation that we heard so far for why the hearsay rule is not being applied in the situation is that the nature of the crimes themselves don't permit a lot of witnesses to be there. Is it possible that one of the other influences on that is the fact that it's just a matter of scope, in terms of there were so many crimes committed and there are so many different potential people who could be named as, you know, the named party, that it's just a matter of resources, in that you don't have enough people to go out on the ground and interview everyone and find a primary source for everything. So it's in this, yes, it's mainly for efficiency purposes that the rule is being relaxed in this case, so that we're able to indict some people and able to get some sense of justice in conclusion to the whole mess, rather than following through on what might be the tighter rules that we'd apply in other circumstances.
That very likely plays a consideration, definitely. But the tribunal is not hunting, but is very is after the witnesses that have seen the most. So, but if that's not available, then they will take the next best. They are pretty careful about who they actually have at The Hague. Part of it is because it costs so much to have them there.
I'd like you to explain a little more, explore why you don't take a detailed statement.
Mm-hmm.
Is it because you don't, is it a matter of strategy? Is it a matter of sympathy for the interviewees? Is it a matter of not wanting to give your adversaries information to take apart? Maybe you could explore that issue a little bit.
Great, thanks. The people want their story to be heard, and that makes them go into that makes them tell their story in great length, and that also makes them tell you stories from other people. Yes, people that they've heard. So the interviews are very long, because one thing we didn't do is we didn't interrupt witnesses in their statements. And the reason why we didn't take detailed statements, or why we were trying not to take too many detailed statements, because of the guidance from the tribunal. The tribunal asked us, please do not take too many details. For ourselves, for information purposes, for the purposes of the report, we would shut down information. But without the witnesses' names, without a precise location, in order for us to put the pieces of the puzzle together. But the guidance of the tribunal was, because we will re-interview the witness, please do not take too many detailed statements.
So let me see if I understand it. It sounds plausible to me. If you're a lawyer trying to put a case together, a prosecutor trying to put a case together, what you want is great witnesses. And then once you have the great witness, you'd like to go and interview the witness and figure out what the witness is going to say and help in a way shape the testimony. Whereas if the statement comes into you already completely laid out, you've got much less room to move. And that is, I take it your function, as far as the prosecutors is concerned, is to find great witnesses for them, not necessarily to elaborate the witness's statements. Am I right about that?
That's correct.
Well, that does make some sense from a strategic point of view. That's what I could imagine. Let me ask you a question then. Would you say something about the problem of language and interpreters? How do you go about gathering these statements across the language barriers? Who is asking the question? Who is answering the question? Who's making the decision that this is a great witness?
We would go to the mayor of the particular town or village, ask him for a quick account of what has happened, go to see the eyewitnesses that he points out to us, and then sit down with that particular eyewitness, preferably without anyone else, and start the statement taking. First, they would give a very brief synopsis, and then we would ask the questions. They would go through one local staff member, through one interviewer. The person was trained to conduct an interview by him or herself, and or also just to translate our questions. There's a form, a 3-4 page form, that is asking detailed questions about a particular incident. And our team, we ourselves ask the question and use the local staff member often as a translator and as the person who would write down the information in Albanian. And then the Albanian form would be taken to the office, and the data entry people would put it into the database that we had created in cooperation with the ICTY. And the database looks like a typical database where we just shot down very quick info on what had happened, where, when, how many people, and that database would go as a CD to the tribunal.
In Albanian or translated
sorry.
By the person when it's input?
I'm sorry, I forgot to mention that. The data entry person would translate it into English.
Uh-huh.
And then you have the English database that went to the tribunal, together with the scanned original Albanian form on the CD.
Great. And let me ask one last question on my part, and then turn back to Hanneke. This seems like a very interesting enterprise for a young person to be engaged in. How does one get the job of doing this? How did you come to do this? How do other people that are on these teams come to be in Kosovo actually doing this sort of thing?
The internationals, there was a website. There is a website for an international crisis group, and there was a notice that they were looking for lawyers. I was the only student, I think, and everyone else was a lawyer. And for me, it was a little bit of a different case. But there was a website, and,
people applied.
People applied. There were hundreds and hundreds of resumes that we had. And out of those hundreds of resumes, we had one person just for personnel. And she was dealing with that and with the local staff. And the local staff came, did an examination, an English examination. And this is how they were chosen.
Great. Hanneke.
Yeah. It strikes me that, I mean, if you really look at the way that you guys are approaching the hearsay problem, it's not all that different than the way the system operates here in the United States. I mean, we have a hearsay rule, but it's riddled with exceptions.
Yeah.
And the reality is that we give a lot of judges discretion, a lot of discretion to decide what evidence comes in and out. But the sort of trade-off is that here in the States, we have very careful appellate review of these types of decisions. Mm-hmm. What kind of provisions are there for, I mean, is there any kind of review, appellate or otherwise?
Yes, there's an appellate panel in the tribunal. And the Tadic, for instance, the Tadic case was appealed. Not that particular decision, the decision to admit hearsay evidence, but the Tadic judgment was appealed, and then the appeals judges, there's a separate appeals judge panel that then considered the case again.
We have to start finishing up. It's gone way, way over the time, but we have one more question from our international audience. So,
in fact, we have two questions from the international audience at this point, we think are interesting. One is from Argentina, and it's a question to Anne, whether you think that as regards crimes committed by military, for example, in Argentina, is it possible to use as well this kind of second-hand testimony? Because they said that, in fact, it is being used now, and, they have a kind of problem with that. So what do you think about this?
Not knowing the details, you know, being a law student, I'm rather cautious in issuing an opinion. What do I think about it? You've got to have strong evidence in order to convict somebody. That's the number one. And you have to ensure a fair trial. You also have to make sure that criminals get tried for the crimes that they've committed. So looking at the facts, that's when you have to make the decisions. I don't think you can make a blanket statement.
And the last question comes from a person from Peru who is now in Spain, actually. And she wonders what was the process, carbon dating processes of these kind of processes were used in Kosovo, because they had a lot of problems for carbon dating as regards people who were killed under the Peruan regime. So whether the same kind of problems arise in the case of Kosovo?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand the word.
Carbon dating. It's the scientific process you use for determining how long a person has been dead, how long the body...
Oh, okay. Yeah, that would be a question for the forensic teams. We didn't do any forensic evidence gathering, simply because we don't have any forensic experts, and that's what the tribunal is taking care of with the help of those government seconded teams like the FBI, so they would know
the answer to that question. I apologize.
I believe I was supposed to ask you a question about identification of victims who have actually been lying in mass graves, but we don't have any time. But maybe she has a brochure, quite impressive, so maybe after class you'd want to take a look at it, or in a minute we can pass it around. I would like to thank you very, very much for being here. It was an absolute honor. As a Dutch person, I'd love to have a bunch of tulips, but I don't, so we'd like to invite you for lunch, first of all. I'd like to thank Professor Nessens for coming up with the idea, because it certainly was not ours, and Gaia, and thank you all for being here, and of course, last but not least, our international audience for tuning in from all over the world.
Thank you very much. Could I ask the Gaia group to come forward and just face the camera so that the international audience could actually see who they've been speaking with and talking with? Maybe you could give a wave, and that would be nice.
There is one last thing. I do think we have a poll, just two questions that you might want to answer on the white papers, so just before we start waving.
So while all of you give a wave to people, could all of you give a hand to everyone? Okay, thanks very much.
So the two questions that we had, maybe, should they just go up?
Eric?
Yeah.
Let's cut.
Okay, if you'd want to fill them in. Thank you very much.
We passed out the white sheets of paper because we were hoping to get a brief response memo from you, if you could, and we'll try to put up the questions on the board. But there are two of them, the first one being your thoughts on, is it better to have permissive hearsay rules enabling more convictions or strict rules protecting war crimes defendants? That's the first one. And secondly, we talked about this a lot, but maybe get down your response. Can judges be trusted to decide what is reliable hearsay? So if you could write your comments on that, we'll collect them at the end of the class. Thank you.
While you're at it, with the piece of paper in front of you, would you do something else on it? Would you give your reaction to this event? I'm interested in whether and how this kind of event works when you are actually dealing with a dual audience. To what extent was it your sense that the international audience contributed to what we were doing, the fact of our doing it to an international audience contributed or detracted? Is this a plus or a minus? And if you have thoughts and suggestions of how to enhance it, I'm sure Gaia would really value that as well.
Thank you. No, I don't think so. Okay. Thank you very much. Yes. I don't actually know for certain. There haven't been that many war crimes tribunals, first of all. Nuremberg, of course, was the big one, and I believe that there was no strict hearsay rule applied at Nuremberg. I believe that, but I don't consider myself a student of Nuremberg. I don't believe there's ever been a hearsay rule applied strictly in the International War Crimes Tribunal context. And for the most part, the hearsay rule is an artifact of the jury trial world, and the war crimes tribunal have really never been structured as jury trial. So my guess would be, I wouldn't call it more than a guess, my guess would be no, that it's
not been the case that the hearsay rule has been strictly applied in prior proceedings. Yes, Victoria? It was applied in Nuremberg.
But there was the evidence. There was no rule.
Yes, right. Right, exactly. All right. I'd like to turn our attention back to the subject of yesterday, the issue of character and the way character is used, and in particular, the way character is used in the context of sexual assault. Let me direct your attention to the actual language of Rule 412 in one particular respect. We talked briefly yesterday about two exceptions to the rule that the victim's sexual predisposition, so-called, can't be proved. Two instances. First the alternate explanation, and second, activity with the defendant. But there's actually a third exception that I wanted you to take a look at. Evidence, here it is here, evidence the exclusion of which would violate the constitutional rights of the defendant. Let me just ask you to think about this for a moment. Here's a statute being, basically, a statute being passed by the Congress. It's in the form of a rule, but Congress passes it. And they put right in the rule, here's the rule that says here, you exclude some evidence, and you accept A, and you accept B, and then we want a third exception for all evidence which it would be unconstitutional to exclude. And I want you to think about that for a moment in the context of other statutes that you know. That is, it's not typical to have such an exclusion in a statute because it's thought that the Constitution is the overriding law. And of course, if the Constitution says that evidence has got to be admitted, it's going to be admitted notwithstanding any rule that Congress passes. So why would they put right in the rule a provision like this? What's the reason for it? Can you imagine a reason for it? Why would you want right in the context of the rule this statement that, of course, the Constitution is paramount? Anybody got a thought? Let me put it in context, as we were speaking about it yesterday. This was a hotly contested issue. This was an agenda item of a movement, a political movement, to get this passed in an attempt to change the dominantly male culture and dominantly male mindset of the court system. Does that give you any further thought as to why a provision like this would be included? Let's take it one step further. Suppose that this provision's not in the rule. And then a case comes up. Let's take a hypothetical case. Defendant is prosecuted for rape. He drives a cable TV truck. He goes around and installs cable in people's houses. And the allegation is that he came to the house of the victim, the prosecutrix, the main prosecution witness, and came in to install the cable television. And while inside the house with this woman, just he and the woman alone, he rapes her.
That's her story. His story. His story is, yeah, I'm a cable TV guy, and I came to her house, and she met me with wearing a negligee, and she invited me to have sex, and I have to tell you, as a cable truck driver, this is not an unusual thing that happens. We actually fell asleep and woke up only hours later. She was really upset that she'd fallen asleep and that the truck had been parked outside the whole time, and she was worried that somehow the neighbors were going to understand what was happening. And so she got all upset, and she charged me, said, threw me out of the house and said, charged me with rape. That's his story. Now suppose he wants to put on evidence from other truck drivers that, in fact, her house is a place that truck drivers love to stop because she regularly invites people in for some kind of quick hit. Is that evidence admissible? What's his case that it's admissible? He says, hey, look, if this is just her word against mine, I'm a clear loser. Because after all, I mean, she did charge me. There's a certain plausibility that just comes from the charge. Why would a woman make a charge unless there was some substance to it? And if what the jury thinks is, as they would quite naturally, that this is just an ordinary housewife like a million others, not someone who regularly invites truck drivers in, then I'm dead. On the other hand, if I can show that it's regular, it's not at all unusual, and that she has a reputation amongst the truck drivers for being promiscuous with the truck drivers, then suddenly my case becomes much more plausible. So, at least from my point of view, this evidence seems highly relevant. This is my defense. And if this rule applies in such a way as to wipe out my defense, and it certainly would, that is, what I want to prove doesn't fit under either of the exceptions. It's not an alternate explanation or prior activity with me. So this rule excludes it. And I therefore challenge this rule as unconstitutional applied to me. Now just suppose that the judge who hears this argument is sympathetic to it and in fact thinks that the whole idea of excluding past sexual history of women complaining witnesses is basically a bad idea, you know, a man of the old school. What happens to the statute? Arash.
Instead of the case going to appellate review,
And if the judge were to exclude the evidence on the grounds that this statute was unconstitutional, what happens to the statute? The way it's written. But if this paragraph isn't in here, the judge declares the statute unconstitutional. And if the statute's declared unconstitutional, then it's back to square one. Go back to the legislature, refight the fight, pass the statute again in some redrafted form. So this paragraph is in here as a preventative measure, as a means of guarding the statute against being declared unconstitutional. The fact that this statute has this clause in here puts in an escape provision, effectively, so that in situations where judges come to a conclusion that the exclusion of this imposed by the rape shield law is too severe on a defendant, that nonetheless the specific situation won't wipe out the general situation. The statute still stands. Yes, Jeremy? I think you're right that it's possible for development to go that way, but it was also definitely and is definitely the case that some statutes are just declared unconstitutional and that's the way they're understood after that. This technical unconstitutional is like, yep, let's get in, yep.
I was just wondering what specific part of the Constitution makes the statute so vulnerable to challenging about it.
What do we know about that? What's the constitutional right that the defendant is asserting? What would you say? Due process? Yeah? Well, let's just stick with this one for a minute. It's thought to be the right to put on a defense. That is, the criminal defendant is thought to have a right to put on a defense as part of due process. It's the same right that generates the idea that a defendant can speak for himself in a trial. So you're not required to speak through a lawyer. It's the same right that in Rock versus Arkansas, the case where the lawyer has his client hypnotized, and after that she remembers that in fact her elbow got hit, that the effort to exclude that testimony on the grounds that it's been polluted by hypnosis as applied to a defendant in a way that prevents the defendant from putting on their defense is unconstitutional. So it's the right of a defendant to defend. Right? Yes. How this doesn't what?
How it doesn't sort of eviscerate the whole rule. I mean, in any he said, she said instance, the only defense is going to be that she said yes. And so anytime you want to bring evidence in, anytime you want to say, my defense is she before I can prove it, you get to do it.
Well, now, let's just think about it a bit. The idea that a defendant has a right to put on a defense isn't a right to put on any evidence the defendant wants to put on. That is, even within the structure of the rules, totally undiluted, the judge has enormous power to exclude evidence, even relevant evidence, if there's a balance of probity and prejudice. That's Rule 404. And we see in Rule 405 that a defendant, maybe the defendant's only defense is, I'm not the kind of a person who would do this sort of a thing. And Rule 405 says, okay, you can testify to that. You're not the kind of a person that would do that sort of thing. But we're not going to let you put on elaborate evidence of your character. We will have you establish character by more efficient methods, even though they may not be as probative as they might be, reputation and opinion. So the idea that a defendant has a right to put on any evidence has got to be distinguished from the idea that somehow, at some point, the denial to the defendant assumes some constitutional stature. So in effect, what we would be exploring is, well, what is this line? At what point does it become constitutional for a defendant to be able to put on evidence?
I guess I'm not sure where that line.
Yeah, I bet you're not.
I hear she does this stuff all the time, then you always get to bring it in.
So now we get to the merits of our hypothetical. I don't mean to suggest with the hypothetical that it automatically falls one side or the other. I think it's a very arguable hypothetical. Let's talk about the merits of it for a minute. In this truck driver situation, is denying the defendant the right to put on the story of her past sexual behavior with other truck drivers, is that something that assumes a constitutional status? First of all, how many of you would simply say her past sexual behavior is just not relevant? It's just not relevant. That is, 412 can be seen as a relevance rule. It's just not relevant to whether this guy raped her. So we've got a number of people who would say that. That is, put it around this way. If you are the jurors who are charged with deciding whether or not this defendant is guilty of rape, you would say, this is information that you wouldn't want to know about. Just as ordinary, common sense people. If you had the responsibility for deciding the outcome, this is evidence you wouldn't want to know about. Think about the idea of relevance. So it's probably the most fundamental idea in evidence. Come back to the rim. We deal with the rim. Remember the investigator? He goes out and after the intersection accident, and he investigates. Well, put yourself in the investigator's state of mind, okay? You've gone to the intersection where this accident took place, and you're eventually going to find this rim out in the field, but what do you do when you get there? Well, you look over the scene, you look and you see if there are marks on the road, from tire marks, you draw a map, you then walk around and you start looking, you're inspecting the area. Suppose you pick up a beer can, empty beer can. Now the question in your mind is, do I put this in a plastic bag and mark where I got it on my little map, or do I just discard it? Beer can. What would you do? Would you put it in the bag and mark it? Or would you leave it there? Is it relevant or is it not? Well, think about the judgment. The judgment that you're making at that point is one that says, what's relevant to me is anything that might fit with the story. I don't really know the story yet. beer can. Probably irrelevant.
Oh, maybe.
Probably mark it and put it in the bag. Popsicle stick. Nah, irrelevant. A rim. All right. Maybe that's got something to do with it. Doesn't know that the rim comes from the car. It's a long way away. But isn't sure that whatever. But, all right, so you get this sense of relevance as you're going along trying to figure out what happened. It's got a contextual quality to it. In some way, it depends on what else you know and what else you don't know. And eventually, what the evidence that's admitted at trial from the jury's point of view is theoretically to be, is you'd like it to be all the evidence that a group of common sense people would like to be able to consider if charged with the job of figuring out what happened. Right, that's like the base idea of relevance. Now, it then gets cut down by efficiency concerns, and it gets stuff excised for other policy concerns, but that's the base idea of relevance. And so, just at a relevance level, the question that you would ask yourself here is the prior sexual history of this complaining witness who's charged the truck driver something that if you had to be charged, if you were charged with figuring it out, making a judgment of guilt or innocence, that you'd want to know about. Arash. No question of that side of it. I mean, that's the reality, and we all recognize that that's where it came from. And no question of this as a reaction to that reality. The question, the constitutional question, is raised by those who say, yes, but in some circumstances, you go too far. And when you go to the point of actually compromising the defendant's right in a substantial way to defend, to tell the defense story, that raises a constitutional issue. So now if I hear you right, you're not suggesting that the evidence isn't relevant. You're suggesting, notwithstanding its relevance, it should be excluded in order to protect the interests of the prosecuting witness and perhaps the broader policy of the state in making prosecution easier. So in a sense, you're suggesting that perhaps a way to think about the rape shield law is, yes, in part you can rationalize it in relevance terms, but when you get to the relevance border and cross it, you then start to see this rule as a privilege rule. That is, this is a rule that in its way is balancing power between men and women, and in its way creating a privilege for women. That is, something that says, notwithstanding the possible relevance of this evidence, we as women have a privilege not to have our sexual histories laid out and our characters trashed in the context of a rape prosecution. It's a way to think about it. It doesn't eliminate the constitutional question just by calling it privilege, but it does change the rhetoric with which one might approach it. Yeah. Well, now I'm not sure I got your example straight. If you're tried for mugging me, and part of the prosecution evidence against you is that you've mugged a bunch of people in the past, that will be typically excluded.
Also, the other way, let's say, I say I beat you up in self-defense. If you tried to mug me with your history, as somebody who's mugged people many times in the past, where is this example coming from?
Yeah, no, I'm not sure. I'm not quite getting the example. Yeah, I'm the victim. You beat me up.
I said it's because you tried to mug me.
Yep. You acted in
self-defense. With your past history as a mugger come into play?
Yes. In fact, I think it would. If we go back to... Let me see if I can... hang on with me one moment. I got up here. Let me. I just want to get to Rule 404. And let's just take a look at it. Here's Rule 404. Here's the propensity rule. Character evidence generally of a person's character or trait of character is not admissible for proving action in conformity therewith on a particular occasion, except. All right, so then we have the character of the accused, where the accused can say, I'm not the kind of a guy who would do this sort of thing. Then we have character of the victim. Evidence of a pertinent trait of the character of the victim of a crime offered by an accused or by the prosecution to rebut the same, or evidence of a character trait of peacefulness of the victim offered by the prosecution in a homicide case to rebut evidence that the victim was the first aggressor. All right, so what this is saying is that if I'm defending on grounds of self-defense, and I want to prove that you were the first aggressor, I can put on evidence that you had an aggressive character, which is basically going to be background evidence. It'll be by reputation or opinion because of Rule 405, but I will be able to put on evidence that you were an aggressive sort. And I would be able to also put on evidence that I am a peaceful sort. And either of those things is possible. Now, the way in which this is the same rule that was the one that embraced the evidence of the past of the victim in a rape situation. So it's 412 changes this rule for purposes of sexual assault, but the base rule would stay for the typical mugging. So let me press you with another hypothetical and see if this pushes you a little bit. Guy's prosecuted for rape. victim says that she and the defendant were in a hotel room and that the defendant assaulted her and raped her. That's her story. His story is that the defendant, that the victim is a prostitute, that he made an assignation with her, that they went to a hotel room, that they had a sexual experience, and that he fell asleep, and as he kind of woke up slightly drowsy, he saw her taking the wallet out of his pants pocket. And he then got up and hit her, and she went screaming out of the room and accused him of rape. That's his story. Could he tell his story with Rule 412? Could he put on evidence that she is in fact a prostitute, that she regularly makes assignations and goes to hotel rooms, maybe even this hotel room? Or would that be excluded by 412? Who would anyone say this evidence is not relevant? Anyone take a shot? You don't think it lends credibility to his story?
Only by detracting from the credibility of the story alone. That I don't think is a legitimate way of detracting from the credibility.
Are we persuaded? Are you persuaded? Steve is not persuaded. Of course, Steve is never persuaded.
I mean, it's crazy. I mean, she's a whore. She probably had sex in her regular ages. And you wouldn't want to bring that in to establish that probably you were exchanging money for sex.
That's what you're making. That the only thing that can be proved is that now you just discredited everything she might have said.
It's not just discrediting. That's one way of looking at it. You're just presenting what likely happened.
But because she was prostituted, like the names that...
She was just having sex willfully than being raped.
That's what she was a prostitute. So prostitutes cannot be raped. It's a criminal statute. Prostitutes cannot be raped.
No, I didn't say that, but it should be allowed to the jury for them to weigh in.
So now Steve says, hey, let the jury sort it out. Here, let's get some others in here. Yes. But the story just starts, and then.
I was going to say the exact same thing. Like, how is he supposed to explain that he's in this hotel room with anyone who's never met before? Prior to this incident, and then there was some engagement in sexual activity out of nowhere.
Chris. Sorry?
Changed my mind.
You changed your mind? Tell us how the change went. And in fact, in all of these cases, knowing what an incredible pain it is to prosecute a rape, the fact that a woman is ready to come forward and do it, in a sense, lends huge amount of credibility to her case. Why would she do it if it were not true? But where does that leave you? You said you changed your mind. Does that leave you to say, whoa, the defendant's really up against it, you really ought to give him every break in putting on his case, because, wow, if she's going to do this. Scott?
Well, in response to these concerns, maybe I'm misunderstanding, but if he can present his own, presumably he's going to testify as to his story, there's nothing preventing him from saying that she's a prostitute. Isn't the issue of whether he can call other people or police reports for arrest? And he can call her whatever she wants, and therefore the story will be coherent from his angle. It's a question of whether it's a robbery or whether the court allows it to be.
Let's suppose that he doesn't take the stand right away. Let's just step it through. The first witness is her. And she tells the story starting from the hotel room. I was out in the hotel room. He slapped me around. He raped me. I ran out and escaped. Your witness.
Okay,
so
that
day,
I accepted money for sexual activity, so, I mean, does that immediately label somebody prostitute? Business.
Yes.
I mean, you didn't ask your prostitute, like, how did you account for the damage, etc., wouldn't you just eventually plead the amendment? Would it be you got to write out self-determination? You're not going to say, oh, I was accepting money for sexual activity. No, not. Yeah, I mean, you just said that the and the jury can say whatever they want to.
It's, but we haven't talked about Fifth Amendment. It's not a typical evidence subject as such. But Fifth Amendment is tricky because it involves waiver. She takes the stand, and she testifies. Now, it's thought, the waiver rules, the way waiver rules work, is that you waive privilege with respect to the subject matter about which you testify. But subject matter is not limited to just the narrative event. The subject matter is actually defined by the issues to which you've testified. So anything that's relevant to the issue to which she testifies, she waives her privilege. Now, she could assert privilege nonetheless, and the judge might be instructing her that she does or doesn't have one, but it's a disaster for the prosecution as soon as that happens. So I think that if the situation that Scott's describing is one where she's testified to something, and now we're going to cross-examine, and in the cross-examination we want to put her testimony into a broader context of events so that it's understood somewhat differently. And if that's what the cross-examination is doing, that is, it's actually relevant to the understanding and to the credibility of the witness, she's going to be in trouble once she's testified. Yes, Steve.
Let's suppose that previously, another man, she said,
oh, if you don't pay me this much more, I'm going to file rape charges. Could you get that in under a signature exception, perhaps, instead of saying, oh, conformity of character?
It would be tough to get it in under signature unless there was something really distinctive about it. But what you're actually raising is... Hold on a sec. What you're actually raising is the issue of prior false allegations of rape. That is, can a defendant in a rape case put on evidence that the prosecuting witness has made prior false allegations of rape? Are prior false allegations of rape excluded by 412? Well, what would you say? What's excluded by 412? Oh, wait a second. I haven't got 412 up here. Hang on one moment. Oh, wait a minute. I've got it bigger here. Evidence generally admissible. The following evidence is not admissible. Evidence offered to prove any alleged victim engaged in other sexual behavior. Evidence offered to prove any alleged victim's sexual predisposition. Does that exclude prior false allegations of rape? Well, it doesn't clearly exclude them, does it? And in fact, in cases where there is evidence of prior false allegations of rape, you start to run up once again against this arguable constitutional barrier. Will the statute privilege a person in a situation where they make an accusation from insulation against evidence that they have a predisposition not to be promiscuous, but to lie? Andy, you got a thought? It's tough. Your question's a good one. That is, clearly, historically, the idea of prejudice in the rules was considered to be prejudice to the defendant's right to reach the truth somehow. And what we're talking about when we're talking about a witness seems much more to be prejudice to the witness rather than to the defendant. And in fact, that argument was made that somehow this rule was not appropriate. In terms of people's understanding of prejudice, this rule effectively started to broaden out the concept of prejudice to be prejudice not just to the defendant, but to the process. And this rule has its major justification in the fact that this is a corrective, this is seen as a corrective to a distortion in the process. And so it's actually something that's dealing with a problem of prejudice to the process. But that really just elevates it to a policy argument and is one that would be made in response to somebody challenging this statute as somehow not appropriate, not authorized. It's a good question. All right, so let me test you on this one. What are the elements of a rape charge? What do you have to prove in order to prove rape? Think for a minute about what you have to prove. You have to prove forcible penetration. against the will of the victim. Is there any state of mind requirement for the defendant? Suppose you have a situation in which the victim's will is overborne, looked at subjectively from the point of view of the victim. But looked at subjectively from the point of view of the defendant, the defendant didn't understand that he was overbearing the victim's will. That's conceivable, yes? You imagine a situation in which the victim is frightened and compliant and thinks, my best bet here is not to resist. I'll just close my eyes and it'll be over. And from the male's point of view, he thinks, hey, she's compliant. Is that rape or not? How many would say that's rape? How many would say not? Those of you who think that's rape, let's make it a little tougher. Suppose, yeah, question?
Thought?
Yeah. Aha. So you would make a turn on whether his state of mind, you credit his state of mind, hypothetically, as believing that she's complying. And then the next question is he reasonable in entertaining that state of mind? All right, so we have a second breakdown. If he subjectively believes that she's complying, but his state of mind is unreasonable, is that rape? And I think most of us would put our hands up. There was actually some little law that is now gone by the boards to the effect that even that was not rape. But it's basically the law of rape, that if he has a subjective state of mind that she's complying, but it's an unreasonable state of mind, then tough luck, defendant, you're guilty of rape. But if we pose the question in terms of the defendant mistakenly believes that she's consenting, and his state of mind is a reasonable one, how many then say rape? So, talk to me about that. Why would you say that's rape? That is, the situation is such that he reasonably believes he's in a consensual situation, and it turns out he's mistaken. It wasn't the case. He's guilty of rape. Yeah.
I'm still confused. Reasonable from whose point of view? Because I think that the point of view here can differ widely, particularly when you get from a gender perspective. I mean, from a woman's point of view, it might be completely unreasonable, but from a man's point of view, you might, from a stereotypical man's point of view, you would think that it was reasonable. I mean, there's still some ambiguity there.
Well, whose point of view would you think would be the appropriate one to look from?
Well, I can see the argument that it would be unfair to judge a male by a standard that he's completely unfamiliar with, but at the same time... I don't know. I'm not going to answer that.
Who wants to help him out?
I just have a question. Is his reasonableness of her compliance something short of her actually saying that she wants to have sex with him? Is it just he sort of reading her body language? What are the facts that make it a line that she is compliant, reasonable? Is it she said, yes, I don't want to have sex with you? Or, you know, he said, I don't want to have sex with you, and she just, you know, says no?
Well, two more twists of the hypothetical. let's take it both ways. One way is she's deathly afraid of this guy. And her will is being overborne. She's afraid this guy is going to kill her. And she thinks her best bet is to just go along with him. Make him happy. And so she says yes. He hears yes. He goes forward. Situation one. Situation two, she's just silent. She's compliant, physically, but there's no actual oral communication. And he believes that she's consenting. Either of those?
Well, I mean, I think you need to know more about what the situation is. I mean, he has brought a gun on her, and she has every right to feel terrified. You know, I mean, you haven't made out nearly enough to be able to make it.
Yep. What happened leading up to the incident, as relevant context, understand what this guy's state of mind is, and a context in which we would judge whether his state of mind was a reasonable state of mind or not. But that would be the enterprise we'd be engaged in. Right? Stuff leading up to the event that bears on his state of mind seems like it's relevant to us.
Does it also matter in terms of assessing the reasonableness of her fear, for instance? I mean, the situation where she has said no and he's been forceful, and she said yes, clearly her fear is reasonable. But in a situation where she's just afraid of men for some unknown reason, she comes up to the bar and says, come back with me, she says yes, and then comes back and says yes, she doesn't give any indication, maybe her fear is not reasonable. So I think the events leading up to it also, like, you have to assess her reasonability too, if what she's saying is yes, I consented, but because it was out of fear. When you have to look at that as well.
Yeah.
I think the only problem with that is I think they envision a scenario where there may be a guy who was a past rapist, where a fear of him would be extremely reasonable, but at the same time, a mere proposition on his behalf doesn't make him guilty, nor does it give him a reason to think that she is compliant, she isn't going to consent based on her own will. And so therefore, although her fear would be reasonable, I still think that she could convict the defendant by those facts alone.
Yeah.
Seems like when you decide it's reasonable, you have to take into account what's reasonable in the context of the specific situation, and then also some societal standard of reasonable that could probably be set pretty high in terms of encouraging people's behavior, so that something like that, considering it to be reasonable that a prostitute necessarily is consenting to have sex, seems to be completely out of the ballpark, and considering that someone is unconscious,
okay, so we certainly see that the reasonableness standard, first of all, we see that in a rape case, you are talking about a crime, is we're charging a defendant with criminal conduct. And the basic element of crime is that you act with a criminal state of mind. You have some kind of criminal intent. That's like fundamental to all crimes, at least almost all crimes. Then when we start looking at the intent of the defendant, we're in the defendant's point of view. We're trying to figure out what the defendant's state of mind is. And we hit these two questions: what is the state of mind, and is the state of mind reasonable given the context? Now the context, as long as we're looking at the defendant's state of mind, must be what the defendant knows. Given what the defendant knows, or should know, is his state of mind that she's consenting reasonable? Okay, that seems to be the structure. Now, we arrive at the point, okay, that's the legal framework. Now, what evidence bears on that? How does the defendant, what latitude will a defendant have in explaining to a jury what he knew? Will he be able to say, yeah, I knew she was a prostitute, or I knew... So, suppose that he wants to put on, just to illustrate the bind that you feel here and that this rule creates in terms of tension excluding things. Just consider an extreme hypothetical. Consider one, a situation in which the defendant has been led to believe by various informational inputs of one kind or another that this person is someone who resists at the beginning but likes to have a little, maybe force is too strong a word, but likes to be pushed and then consents. Imagine that. Is it imaginable? Yes, that's imaginable. And let's suppose that that's what the guy thought happened. That's what I thought happened. I was a little tough at the beginning, and then she complied just the way Tom, Dick, and Harry, my friends that told me about their past experiences with her, said it was going to be. Could he testify to that? Could he testify that that was my state of mind and I had these informational inputs from Tom, Dick, and Harry? And if he could testify to that, can he then corroborate his own testimony by calling Tom, Dick, and Harry? Who will testify that, yeah, we told the defendant that about our experience with the victim and just how she'd act. Or is that barred by the rape shield law? Yeah. Well, just understand it in evidentiary terms as a problem in what the evidence relates to. What are you trying to prove with the evidence? If you're trying to prove that she consented, as if that's the object of proof, and your mode of proof is to say she engaged in various promiscuous activities in the past, and that makes it more likely that she has a promiscuous character. And the fact that she has a promiscuous character makes it more likely she consented on the occasion with this defendant. That's the old propensity line of logic, and that's what Rule 412 clearly tries to bar. Okay? But now you come over and you're trying to prove something else, not that she subjectively consented. The defendant's now trying to prove that he subjectively thought she consented, and that his thinking that was reasonable, given what he knew. That's a different context in which we're talking about evidence. So that if the defendant would say, I'm not calling Tom, Dick, and Harry to tell you what they did with her. I'm calling Tom, Dick, and Harry to tell you what they told me they did with her. It's only relevant as it bears on my state of mind. But as it does bear on my state of mind, I should be able to prove that. Does that make sense?
It sort of makes sense, but I still don't buy it because it doesn't, I don't think that is a reasonable basis for making that subjective determination, because it's still basically going toward whether or not she's consenting. And she's saying, well, I thought she was consenting because of what my buddy said.
All right, I want to take a break at this point. I've held you for too long. I'll come back and I want to talk about this a little bit more, get a little more reaction, then I want to do a little Vinny, and then we're going to be out of here today.
I'm going to go to the next one. Come over here, I want to just look at some. Yeah, I could do that. I think we've done enough with this. Oh, it's very tough. Right? Okay. Like a relatively long essay, and then
Think through the ideas of the class. This is not the rules that I've talked about. You know, not every rule, and I'm not going to be asking picky questions about mine. It's not like, oh, you got this phrase wrong. Right. No, I appreciate it. Right. I'm happy with both. I'm really happy with both. It's got a little of that quality. I mean, you know, generally speaking, you're probably better off on 5 years than me. But if you genuinely learn something, just, you know, don't go with a jerk, or this should have been this way rather than that way, or something like that, that's probably not the case. If there was a genuine learning experience, then it would be something negative. That's really, really what I want to hear. Those the 750 words that were not in the novel. In fact, I'm going to actually ask people to state what worksheets they were in and what they're using them in. And that's the basis that I'm going to use for looking at all of the text words. In fact, the title is 24, but I think some of them will be anonymous.
Sense impression.
If I say to you, that's far going by. And you overhear me say that. You don't see it yourself. And I'm gone out of the jurisdiction. When trial comes, you take the stand and testify that I said that. My statement is hearsay, but falls within the exception of it was a present sense impression on my part. It's like the play-by-play description of what's happening. It's like a contemporaneous observation. It's permitted in the test, nothing wrong with it. It doesn't have to be obvious. Just to clear out it out of your mind. It doesn't make any difference whether it's in the jurisdiction or how it is. You don't need him to testify. You can testify. Okay.
Really, I'm really. I just started the book. I'm not the other person on the team. Trying to give a little narrative in class when they're making a pitch. I thought it was really nice. It was a real statement of enthusiasm. And then, you know, just like jumping into my key and buying this book. It's a shame that, I don't know, for whatever reason, most of the members of my family are math geniuses, so they have no tolerance for my shortcomings. So they tried to beat math into me with
Let's come back to order, please. Come on, back to order, please. Let me just say a word to conclude this little segment on evidence of prior sexual behavior. You can see as we talk that there is underlying the evidence question issues of the substantive of law, as what is the law of rape. And you can see that the law of rape itself is expressing norms about how men and women relate sexually. To what extent is it, to what extent is the relationship legally structured in such a way so that there is a presumption of non-consent, which from the defendant's point of view
has to be overcome with affirmative, demonstrable evidence of consent before the defendant's state of mind becomes one that we would consider to be not criminal if he goes forward with sex. And you can see from the development of the rape shield law that we're obviously in a context where norms are changing, where what's happening in the society is movement from norms that existed 50 years ago to where we are now and directions of where we're going. What I'd like you also to see is that the evidence rules themselves are vehicles through which the norms change. It's the substantive law hasn't changed. Nobody's changed the rape statute. But when you change the way in which a statute or elements of an offense can be proved, you actually are changing the substantive law as you're doing it. It's through the evidence rules that you get shifts in the norms. What actually happened as this rape shield law came in is there were loads of judges who resisted it, who thought, no, no, the old law was right. The common sense that they'd been working with for years as the kind of male state of mind embodied in the law and the evidence rules was right. These changes that the rape shield law produced were products of the women's movement to be resisted. And bunches of judges actually resisted. And if judges want to resist, they can find ways to resist. So you can find cases, 1980s, you know, right after the rape shield law, where the state of mind of the defendant suddenly expands and becomes a big deal. And Tom, Dick, and Harry, who used to just testify to what they did with the victim, now you get testimony from Tom, Dick, and Harry about what they said to the defendant they did to the victim, with some judges saying, yes, okay. As you look at the flow of cases, if we were to just go deeply into it, you'd see that that's diminishing, and there really has been a quite marked change in the courts. And what I want you to have a feel of is that that's something that is stimulated through and expressed by the evidence rules and the way they get applied. I've always thought that this particular subject was amongst the most interesting in evidence. From the first time I kind of went to a real court, just a momentary story here before I go, Vinny. One of the first things I did when I graduated from law school, I don't know why I'd waited, is I went to court, and I just happened to walk into Superior Court down here in Boston to a rape trial. It was a trial that started in the morning, and it was literally over by lunchtime. There were basically three witnesses that testified. There was the victim, there was a medical examiner, and there was the defendant. And the medical testimony was not particularly severe. This was not a big injury case at all. And the victim told one story, the defendant told another story. And the jury retired. They came back, they retired at lunch. By the end of the day, they were back with a verdict. And I left the trial after lunch. I had no idea which story seemed right. They both told what seemed relatively plausible stories, and the medical testimony hadn't been explicit. Came back, the jury returns a guilty verdict. And the judge sentences the defendant to 25 years. And I thought, whoa, look at that. That is really something. And what struck me was how thin the base was on which the result rested. One person's word, another person's word, non-definitive, medical, jury sizes them up, boom, sayonara. And It just happened that as in the public defender's office, that person in prison became a kind of continuing post-verdict. I think my wife, Fern, actually, when she was in the public defender's office, had something to do with that guy getting out 8 years afterwards. And it just has always been something that framed my feeling that the idea of evidence to build a foundation for a verdict that you think is solid actually translates into feeling comfortable as a member of the society about seeing someone have his life materially altered by this little thing that we call a trial. This is an issue that's got enormously important consequences to it on both sides. But what it ultimately comes down to is whether you think that you, at least I think it comes down to, from an evidentiary and lawyer point of view, whether you think that we can run a trial process with respect to the charge that produces a credible verdict. Eric. That's true.
Right. And I can't think of any other crime where that's so. So I think there is a recognition that sex is different when it meets up with criminal law. And now, I guess, it's being looked at very differently.
Yeah. The corroboration rule has gone by the wayside in many places. That's part of what's changed. Rape, it's become much easier to prosecute rape cases. Okay, now I want to deal with Minnie here and go from the one to the other in some very significant way. Have I got you?
So we can hold on to this little shit.
I'm a special envoy instructor of forensic studies for the Federal Bureau of Investigation. How long have you been in that position? 18 years.
No.
You're a good specialist.
If you wish.
Objecting his witness being called at this time. We've been here a long time in order to see testimony. No discovery of any tests he's conducted or reports he's prepared, but as the court is aware, the defense is entitled to advance notice of any witness who will testify, particularly those who will give scientific evidence so that we can properly prepare for cross-examination, as well as to give the defense an opportunity to have the witness's reports reviewed by a defense expert who might then be in a position to contradict the veracity of his conclusions.
That is a lucid, intelligent, well thought out objection.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Overruled.
Now, Mr. Wilton, these photos of tires belonging to the defendant's car, and these are photos of the tire marks left by the assailant's car as it fled the convenience store. Now, are you familiar with these?
Yes, I am.
Could you elaborate, please?
We compared the tire marks outside the convenience store with the rear tires of the defendant's car. They're the same model and size tire. Visually model XGV, size 75 R14 and 20.
They're the same size and model tire. Anything else?
Yes, indeed. The car, leaving the convenience store, spun its rear tires dramatically and left the residue of rubber on the asphalt. Now, I took a sample of that rubber and analyzed it. I also took a sample of rubber from the rear tires of the defendant's Buick and analyzed that too.
Huh.
What kind of equipment did you use to find this out?
I used the Hewlett-Packard 57 tank, fuel column, gas chromatograph for flame analyzation detectors.
No, no, that thing covered charge.
It's only on 4 months.
Now, Mr. Wilbur, what was the result of your analysis?
The chemical composition between the two samples was found to be identical.
No further questions, Your Honor.
Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Wilbur. Court will take a 60-minute recess for lunch.
Your Honor, I respectfully request a full day's continuance to the Wilbur wish stuff.
Request denied.
Thanks a lot.
I wish you a minute.
Yes.
I'd like to speak to you in my chambers. You're a dead man.
Dead?
That's right. I was catching the clerk of your office last morning knew about Jerry Gallo. You wonder what you replied.
Did you say Jerry Gallo?
Yes, did.
Gallo with a G?
That's right.
Jerry Gallo's dead?
I'm aware of that.
Well, I'm not Jerry Gallo. I'm Jerry Gallo. C-A-L-L-O.
All right. Let's get this cleared up right now. Hello, this is Judge Chamberlain House. Can I speak to clerk? Okay, I'll be here. You can call back after 3. That gives you a stay of execution. That's about some miracle you have to learn win this case in the next 90 minutes. And good luck.
Thank you.
something. Very, very little. Is it possible the two separate cars could be driving on Michelin model XGV 75R14s?
Of course.
Let me ask you this. What's the best-selling single model tire being sold in the United States today?
The Michelin XGV.
And what's the most popular size?
75R14.
The same size as our defendant's car.
A two faded green 1964 Buick Skylark convertible.
Excuse me. While I'm asking you, is it the most popular size of the most popular tire in the defendant's car?
Well, yeah.
Yes. Thank you. No further questions.
Mr. Gambit, your first witness.
I haven't got enough time to play the whole sequence, and I'd rather save the denouement of this thing for tomorrow anyway. So it's an appropriate time to take a break. We've just got one more segment to go with it. I think I'm just going to let you go at this point. You get the setup here. You got the expert witness. We got another expert witness coming tomorrow. Let me just mention something so I don't forget. I'm sorry. Don't know why my mic is not on. Whoa. All right. First of all, where do we meet tomorrow? I'd like to meet again here. I'd like to finish up in here. We've gotten used to coming here. I'd like to finish here. Second, with respect to the 750-word essay that you're going to do, I'll make this clear in other ways, but I'd like to let you know right now, that essay is not going to be anonymous. The exam you take will be, but for the essay that you write, I want to know right at the top of it, your username, your full name, and the name of the work group that you're in. The exam will be anonymous, but I'm going to work with the essays with respect to the workshop activity and use that as my means of looking at the email correspondence with respect to the workshops. So let's see. That, I believe, oh yes, would you pass in your pieces of paper? And I'll see you for our last day tomorrow right here. Oh, good. Excellent.
I'm
I'd like that, but it's not absolutely necessary if it's a big problem. I'd like that.
Otherwise,
yes, let me say yes.
Is it there?
Yes, otherwise we'll get all confused. I think that is the best.
Okay.
Okay, good.
Okay. And then I don't know the essay where it comes or the comes.
I'd like you to do the 750 word essay.
Yes.
But not you. Yep. I want your idea of the well, actually, if you look at right, there's both, the process and the topic. I'm interested in both. I'm interested in both. Thanks. It would be very good if you forwarded me the whole batch. Hi. No, it's not absolutely required. If you got something that's really going to knock my socks off, other, go for it.
Thanks very much.
Did you actually duck the police officer?
No, they tried to get those guys out. So they just asked the police officer, did they talk to you?
Yeah, it was
really, really nice. It's ridiculous.
Well, they didn't all talk to
me too much. Good, I'm fascinated. That's great. Good. I thought it was a very nice session with the international stuff. I suggest to them that they take the chat log and edit the crap out of it and send it around, because there was intelligence on there. There was better formulated questions online than in class. And the fact that knowledgeable people text. Thanks so much for being here.
I don't know what exactly did that, but I feel like it definitely did that.
I just hope we can take it someplace to be seen. There's good places to go. There's no question about that. Good people to go. Just so should be possible. It was so wonderful to have you up here. That's true. Those pictures that they put up there, you look at them, it's like the Holocaust all over again.
Presenter, visitor, Anna is going to come and not stay for lunch. Oh, she's concerned as I am
about getting out.
Well, they can't.
Well,
they did this last time.
Yeah, they did this way.
You were
trying to get this last time. There's another storm coming. It's probably hit New York already. But not any major
things. Last time I took the train was for
forever. Oh, God. To get back to New York for me?
I'm going to go to the next one.
If you have something you really want to direct on, you probably would get an opportunity for money. But a writing opportunity is quite when it actually happens, it seems so not so ordinary.
Yeah.
When the guy goes behind, that's it. Because I know what's in for us, I almost know anything about the
What's the deal with these computers?
Yeah, it would be nice actually if you guys got computers and stuff out there.